On January 17th of this year, an inmate at the United States Disciplinary Barracks, a military correctional facility on Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, was summoned from a prison workshop by a team of security personnel. And she was taken to protective custody where a TV was turned on to CNN. That's how Chelsea Manning learned that after nearly 7 years of confinement, her 35-year sentence had been commuted by President Obama. She'd been convicted for violation of the Espionage Act and other offenses after she'd sent nearly 750,000 classified or unclassified but sensitive military and diplomatic documents to WikiLeaks. After she was released this past May, Ms. Manning sat down with Matthew Scherr, a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, for an exclusive story on her actions as an intelligence analyst for the U.S. Army in Iraq, the impact of those actions, and on her new life as a transgendered woman. Matthew Scherr joins us now via Skype. Welcome to our show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can you tell us the time and setting for the interviews with Chelsea Manning? How long did you spend with her, and how soon was it after she was released from prison?
Yeah, so this was about 8 days after she was released, 8 or 9 days, give or take. She had been released in the middle of May, and because she'd spent the previous 7 years in various states of incarceration and military facilities and on military bases in the Middle East, she understandably wanted a little bit of a break. So she spent a week in a safe house at a location where I was not privy to where exactly that was. And then she came to New York for a little while to do this interview with me, and she did one other TV interview. And we spent on and off about 6 days together, some of it in formal interview settings and some of it just hanging out when the recorder wasn't running.
I thought I knew most of the story based on newspaper reports, but Chelsea Manning was very open with you, and there's lots new in your piece. Were you surprised by how revealing and self-critical she was at times?
Yeah, I was surprised by that. I mean, I think you're right. To a certain extent, a large part of the story has been told, although it was one piece of the story, right? It was her actions as whistleblower and the way that she was caught in the early stages of her incarceration. What I think that she hadn't really addressed and hadn't really been able to be open about was her transition, her gender identity, how she came to understand who she was. And yeah, I mean, look, I said to her on multiple occasions that I wouldn't have wanted to be asked the questions that I was asking her. They're deeply personal questions, and she was candid in a way that I found myself really respecting.
Also, how that transition affected her actions at any given time, because it was changing over the years.
It was changing over the years. And I think, you know, one of the questions that I'm still grappling with, and I think she's still grappling with, are how these two things are connected, right? I mean, she's an icon in different ways. She's a whistleblowing icon, and she's now an icon for the trans movement. And I don't think they're entirely separate, right? I mean, I don't think that you can remove one struggle from another struggle. But I think that talking to her about that and where those two paths intersect was some of the most revealing for me.
She was going to first give the information that she disclosed to the New York Times or the Washington Post. Why didn't she?
She did initially have that in her mind, that she would try to approach a newspaper. And she did. She did try to approach the Post and the New York Times. You got to remember that this is pre-Snowden, right? This is 2009, 2010. And now you sign online and you go to a journalist's Twitter page and you see their PGP key. There's all sorts of information on how to transmit data securely to that journalist. But at the time, she was having a very difficult experience getting anybody to understand how she wanted to transmit that data. So she eventually sort of, the way she describes it is she did try, but then gave up because she was worried that she'd be found out immediately if she tried to go the traditional route through the front door of a newspaper or a TV station.
But before they got all of this stuff from her, WikiLeaks was kind of a minor player.
Yeah, I think you look back to around that time, let's say 2009, and WikiLeaks is in the papers a little bit to a certain extent, let's say, but you know, it was nowhere near the saturation point that it is now. People didn't really know who Julian Assange was outside of hacker circles. They weren't really, you know, he'd published some smaller leaks, but nothing on the scale of what Manning provided to WikiLeaks.
Why did she wind up choosing WikiLeaks to receive the documents?
She knew about Assange and Julian Assange, the co-founder of WikiLeaks, and the platform WikiLeaks, actually, from her training, is how she explained it to me as an intelligence analyst. She was warned about this site and started to think about it. She started to participate in online chats related to WikiLeaks. So it was on her radar. She knew about it. And essentially what had happened was she goes home on leave from her deployment to Iraq. And it's at that time that she thinks about, okay, maybe I do the Times, maybe I do Washington Post, maybe I do Politico, but she can't get through to them. And she says, okay, look, WikiLeaks is set up to process this information, is set up to receive this information. I can get it to them quickly and securely. And so that's who she ends up going with. To hear her explain it, it very much was a matter of convenience. It wasn't necessarily an alignment of values with Assange and WikiLeaks, although I think there was some of that going on, but she did not choose WikiLeaks for that specific reason.
The first time we even talked about WikiLeaks on this show was in regard to some of the materials she had leaked, the helicopter shooting that took the lives of several Reuters journalists.
Yeah, that was the one that we remember in retrospect, right? Because it was so visceral. That's the video shot from the cockpit of an Apache. And it was, you know, it brought home, she said to me repeatedly, and she said in the past, that what her hope was with all of this was to make people see what she was seeing as an intelligence analyst. And what she was seeing was material like that. Now, not everything, not all of it was as dramatic as that, right? And it was two very different types of documents that she's best known for. One are the war logs, which are actions from reports from Afghanistan and Iraq, and the other are the diplomatic cables, the State Department cables. The Apache video fits into the war material.
She's only 29 years old now. Given that she was just in her early 20s when she leaked the documents, how much of the big picture of leaking and realizing the impact do you think she had?
I think it's something that she's still processing. I mean, I think about where I was from a worldview standpoint when I was 20, 21, and I don't think my understanding of the world was particularly nuanced at the time. She seems to have been more precocious about politics and world affairs than most, but I think that she was still really young. She was still working through a lot of things. That said, I asked her this repeatedly. I said, you know, listen, do you look back and say, okay, I regret this, or I wish I'd done this differently? And she doesn't. You know, she's served her time for her actions, and she said to me, you know, my values are the same. I would have done it no matter what. But I think you're right. I mean, the age thing is something that it's very easy to forget, how young she was then and how young she is now.
I'm speaking with Matthew Scherr, whose article Becoming Chelsea Manning appeared in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Didn't she come from a fairly conservative family?
Yeah, she grew up in Oklahoma, on the far outskirts of metro Oklahoma City. Her dad was very conservative, the way she tells it, and he had been in the military himself. You know, I think that right now, in 2017, if a child is dealing with something with their gender identity, teachers are better equipped to help that child in a lot of cases. And I think that what happened to her in Oklahoma was that people weren't equipped. Her parents weren't equipped. Her teachers weren't equipped. And I think that, you know, I tried to do this in the article, tried to look back at the source of her earliest turmoil. And it does come from that time in Oklahoma when she really felt that she was invisible to a certain degree, that there was no one who understood her at all. And I think that that continues to be, you know, she still looks back at that period of her life with a lot of pain, I think.
How old was she when she first had the feeling that she might be a female?
The way that she describes it, it's very early. No, I think that in preparation for reporting this piece, I read on Chelsea's suggestion of a lot of different trans memoirs, and they do describe something similar to what she describes, which is that there's a feeling, it's kind of, you have trouble describing what it is because you're really young. And she says, you know, one of her earliest memories is saying to her dad, well, look, why can't I be a girl? Why can't I play with the girls? And her dad said, well, it's just the way things work. So I think that, you know, we're talking very early in her life, but again, there was no vocabulary for it. There was no analog for her on television or in movies. So she lived with this from a very early age without being able to describe to people exactly how she felt. And indeed, it would be years and years before she was able to describe to people what she felt.
Although there already was Renee Richards as a prominent figure, there were other people. Her father, you say, didn't understand. In fact, when she reported that the kids were picking on her, he said, man up and punch them in the face.
Yeah. Yeah, no, look, I mean, you're right. There were definitely trans figures there. I don't know if right now we live at a time where someone like Janet Mock can sell, thousands and thousands of copies of her memoir, and younger trans people do have somebody that's readily accessible. I think probably if Chelsea had looked, eventually she would have found someone, but she's thinking, when she's describing this, she's thinking of what she saw on, let's say, MTV or what she heard on the radio. And there wasn't, the trans movement had not saturated, had not reached the mainstream in the way that it has now. But yeah, so her father, when she was picked on, said, look, go back and punch these kids in the face, tell them off, which of course was the advice that she precisely did not need at the time, right? She needed someone who could listen to her and could think through some of what she was experiencing with her. But, you know, her dad was not in that place, and well, neither was her mother.
Why, considering her confusion about her sexuality, did she join the army? She must have known that that was just going to cause more problems for her.
Well, I think that she thought that it might man her up, as she put it. This was at the back of her head, that she'd been suffering from this gender confusion, and that, okay, look, she says to herself, look, if I enlist, maybe this will go away. Maybe, you know, it's wishful thinking, obviously. In retrospect, it's easy to see it as wishful thinking. But I do think that figured into her decision, that she thought, well, I'll be in this masculine environment. I won't be able to think about wearing women's clothes, or I won't be able to think about my gender identity. I'll be concentrated on my task. But I don't want to frame her thinking to enlist as just that, because it was a bigger decision. It was, she wanted money for college down the line. She wanted to be able to serve her country. She was and continues to be a patriotic person. But I think that did figure into her thinking that, you know, this will change me. This will cure me in some way.
She had already experimented with wearing women's clothes and makeup, especially after her parents broke up and she spent some time in Wales with her mother. Now, in the army, she was harassed in boot camp. But was there any talk about her leaving at that time? Or were her special abilities, she knew a bit about coding, did they help get her assigned to the job that she wound up in?
It's astonishing looking back at her experience in the military. It was a bumpy, bumpy road from the very beginning. She had an extremely hard time in boot camp, hurt her arm, should have probably left boot camp, but got processed back in. Now, at the time, this is 2007, 2008, and, you know, there was a real hunger on the U.S. military's part for more bodies for Iraq and Afghanistan, for the wars that were consuming people. And there was a decision, probably a military-wide decision. I haven't studied this as thoroughly, but at least in Manning's case, the decision seems to have been made that, okay, you know, she is having trouble, but we need somebody like her. We need an intelligence analyst who understands computers, who is smart, who is precocious, who's really bright. And she goes through this thing where over and over again, she gets into trouble. She gets into trouble at Fort Drum, where she's in New York, where she's stationed initially for flipping a table. Later, when she goes to Iraq, she gets in trouble for confrontations with superiors, and in one case, even punches a superior in the face. And at each juncture, she is allowed to stay. There's some punitive measures that are taken, but she does remain in the military. Now, obviously, again, this is in retrospect. You can sort of we see this. You can see this sort of path that she was taking. But to me, it's the path of somebody who was crying out for help and who needed help that they just weren't provided.
How would she learn to code?
She learned from her father at an early age. Her father had been in military intelligence and then had moved to Oklahoma to run IT for Hertz, the car rental company. And he had always brought home computers on a yearly basis, a new computer, and Chelsea would get the old one, the last one that he was replacing, her father was replacing. And she's dabbled from an early age, 10, 9, 8 years old maybe, and she learned CSS first, and she played video games pretty regularly. So she was a true digital native in that sense.
What information did she have access to when she was in Iraq? Did she have top secret security clearance?
She had access to just about everything. I mean, I think that there was material that was off limits to her, but she was in Iraq in the American hub of the war there, and she had access to all the databases. She had access to the material, they're called significant actions or SIGACs, that, as I say in the piece, make up the mosaic of the wars at that time and still do. Reports from firefights, photographs, videos, every little piece of these wars would go into these databases, and it was her job to analyze them and present them to superiors. All of that she had access to. She had access to State Department cables. She had access to reports from the American prison at Guantanamo. You name it, she could get her hands on it. And it, you know, later at her trial, it came up, well, how does a person like this have a relatively low-level analyst have access to all this? But she did. It was all there.
Did what she was seeing affect her view about the role of the United States in Iraq and in the Middle East?
Definitely. And I think that when she enlisted, she had a relatively simplistic view of American foreign policy by her own acknowledgement. She said, you know, I saw it in black and white, and I wanted to help the American war effort. But even before she leaves for Iraq, she starts to have access to these databases and be able to see the videos and reports. And still, she holds strong to her conviction that she can help. But being in Iraq, as she explains it, gives her a front row seat to everything that had been abstract before. She's able to actually interact with soldiers. She's able to see the streets that she'd only seen in maps. And I think that it starts to grate on her, right? It starts to wear on her, and she starts to be a little bit more awake to what was actually happening on the ground.
On the other hand, you say that when she was downloading all of this material from the significant action report, she said, let's protect sensitive sources. Let's protect troop movements. Let's protect nuclear information. Let's not hide missteps. Let's not hide misguided policies. Let's not hide history. Let's not hide who we are and what we're doing. So she was deciding what was appropriate to release and what wasn't?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think that there is no doubt that what she did and her actions had an effect on people in the field. There's been an ongoing debate about whether people were harmed because of what she did. And in fact, earlier this morning, BuzzFeed published a report, a formerly classified report on her actions and the impact. The government has acknowledged that nobody was killed because of her actions, but people's cover was exposed, and it did, when she was hoping to unveil and sort of lift the veil on what the United States was doing She did it in a relatively blanket way that was not necessarily super protective of individuals. And I think, you know, I think that that's something that she still grapples with. But I don't want to put words in her mouth right now, but I will say that I think that in her mind, it's a trade-off, right? I mean, that there are, that in making this impact, in exposing what was happening in Iraq and Afghanistan, in exposing what the diplomatic machinery actually looks like, there was going to be a cost to that, and she was willing to accept that.
I'm speaking with Matthew Scheer, S-H-A-E-R. His article, Becoming Chelsea Manning, appeared in the New York Times Magazine last Sunday, the 18th. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Matthew Scheer. His article, Becoming Chelsea Manning, appeared in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine, and we have a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org/lowpate. What realization did Chelsea have about what Americans knew and thought about what was happening in Iraq when she had a short leave back home?
This, to me, was one of the most eye-opening experiences that I had with her, listening to this realization that she had. She described going home in the middle of her deployment. She had a 2-week leave. She went home to the Washington, D.C. area where her aunt lived, and she was going to relax. And she describes riding around on the metro and feeling like there was a war that she had just left that was impossibly distant in the United States, that people had forgotten about it or weren't paying attention, and that every day in Iraq she was being exposed to the impact of that war, the casualties, the civilian deaths, the damage to neighborhoods in Baghdad near where she was stationed, and that it was two worlds. That's how she described it to me, that it was two worlds, and she was having trouble connecting them. And it was just, she wanted the people in the world in America to be able to see what she had seen.
And she thought of herself as a truth teller?
She did. Yeah, she did. I mean, I don't think that she set out to do this. I think she doesn't like the comparison, but I do think that there is a difference between Chelsea Manning and someone like Julian Assange or Edward Snowden, who are able to really seem to have put a lot of intellectual thought into their leaks or their actions, whereas I think that for Chelsea it was not as carefully thought out. It was something that she felt, she started to feel extremely strongly about, and it built up in her until she felt like she couldn't stay silent anymore. And then at some point she did start to feel like, well, if nobody else is going to do this, it's going to be on me to do.
Well, as you mentioned, no one, as far as we know, has died as a result of the leaks. But what did it do to the state of our intelligence sources in Afghanistan and Iraq and around the world, for that matter?
Well, it did. There were partial. So let me take a step back. When these were published, when the war logs were published, some names were redacted by WikiLeaks and by the newspapers that published them here in the United States. Other names were not. There were names that were made public. And when we're thinking about the diplomatic cables that Manning gave to WikiLeaks, those had immediate impact, right? I mean, there were State Department people who were pulled back to the United States immediately because what they'd said in those cables was embarrassing. This wasn't just confined to the United States. There were government employees in Germany who were recalled from their posts. I think that what it ended up doing to us, to this world that we live in, is made us aware of how easy it was and easy it continues to be for somebody to do something like this. I mean, we are talking about a mouse click, right? We are talking about the transfer of files and then a mouse click for hundreds and thousands of files to be exposed to the public. And I think that we have changed our approach to a certain extent, or we've at least started to be cognizant of how easily that kind of thing can happen.
So has it changed the way intelligence is now communicated? Are we using different systems?
No, I don't think we are. I mean, I think we're using variants on the same systems. The way that I understand it, there is the access to lower level folks, the access to lower level folks like Chelsea Manning are permitted has changed. There isn't that blanket access that she was permitted. But, you know, I think also what's happened is there's been an understanding that we need to, or on the understanding on the government's part, that a crackdown needs to happen. And you saw that start to happen after Manning under the Obama administration, that, you know, we're going to go after people who leak, and we're going to go after it in the harshest possible way as a deterrent. And you see that even now with somebody like Reality Winner, the NSA contractor who was arrested. And I think that, no, I mean, look, I don't think we've undergone a sea change in the way that we're handling sensitive information. I do think that we're cognizant of the fact that it is very easy for people to get their hands on. But yeah, I think it's something we're still working through. Let's put it that way.
An appellate brief filed last year by Manning's legal team implied that the Army's inability to treat her gender dysphoria was a contributing factor in the leaks. What does she say about that?
This is a very tangled up and complicated issue for her, and I think also for her attorneys, because you don't, when this appellate brief essentially says that she was crying out for help, didn't get the help, and that may have sort of helped to drive her towards the leaks that she eventually undertook. Now, if you read into that at a certain level, is it saying that if she had been permitted, if she'd been given access to help, that she would not have leaked those documents? Or if she was not transgender, would she not have leaked those documents? Her answer to that is, my values would have been the same. As she said repeatedly to me, I would have done it. But you do see in the appellate brief, which does detail the pain, the obvious pain that she was going through while in Iraq and even before deployment. And it's brutal, right? I mean, this is a time when transgender people, as far as the military was concerned, did not exist. So she was at a point where she was, as I say in the piece, had two enormous secrets. One, that she'd started to communicate with WikiLeaks, and the other, that she considered herself to be a woman, that she was transgender. And I think that the two secrets did become tangled up and did cause her a lot of pain in those months right before she was arrested.
But she couldn't keep it totally secret, and that's what led to her being found out and arrested.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It's something I asked her. Would you have gotten away with this if you could have? In other words, would you have been a Snowden who comes clean about your actions and puts a name to the leaks? And she said that she would have eventually gone public with her decision. She would have said, okay, this was me, these were my leaks, and this is why I did it. She didn't have the chance to do that because she was arrested before she could, but she maintains that she would have gone public with her identity.
Now, she was sent to a men's prison, and the guards were not all that sympathetic. When did the Army decide to sanction hormone therapy for soldiers and also for military prisoners?
So she had a bit of an odyssey through the military justice system. She was not at Leavenworth, where she ended her spell in military prison until 2013 after her court-martial. So she goes to Kuwait, to a military base in Kuwait, and then she goes to Quantico. And through all of that time, she is in a men's facility being treated as if she was a man, even though she tells the guards and the staff and says, look, I'm a woman, I identify as a woman. She goes to a pre-detention center in Kansas, then she goes to the court-martial, and then in 2013 she comes back to this disciplinary barracks at Fort Leavenworth in 2013, and that's when she starts fighting for the transition. Now, that also lines up, that time frame, 2013-2014, is the time frame when Don't Ask, Don't Tell is starting to be repealed, and there's a larger conversation about the right of transgender people to openly serve in the military. So she is waging this fight to get hormones from, let's say, late 2013 through 2014. In 2015, she's finally allowed to have access to the hormones. But it is very much, it's concurrent with that, with Don't Ask, Don't Tell being repealed, that this is all going on.
She claims to suffer from PTSD. Is that, does she say that's because of all the time she spent in solitary confinement?
She says that it's partially because of Iraq, interestingly enough, and I think that there's probably something to that. She was near the front lines. She witnessed, both in the material she was viewing and firsthand, the violence of war. But sure, I mean, I think also the solitary plays a big role in that, right? I mean, in Quantico especially, where she was for almost a full year, she was in solitary for much of that time, and it was unbelievably grueling. It has been, since been compared to torture, and that does, there's no doubt that later in her time at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas, when she was sent to solitary, that she was having flashbacks to her time in Quantico.
You say that her leak was the largest leak of classified records in American history. And you quote Denver Nix as saying that the leaks were the beginning of the information age exploding upon itself. So has everything changed as a result?
There's so many different levels to that question, and it's something that I grappled with in writing this. I think that insofar as Manning's original aim to wake up the American public to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, I'm not sure that she fully succeeded in that. I think we're still at a place where we do forget, where it's easy for us to forget about what's happening in those wars, and I don't know that a whole lot of minds were immediately changed by her leaks. The diplomatic cables got some people fired. It opened our eyes to the kind of communiques that diplomats have. But again, I don't think it was radically world-altering. What I do think was world-altering is this idea that the Nix quote for me was so poignant, because it gets at this idea that we've been, our world had been opening up through the internet. We've been storing and communicating more and more digitally. And what Manning did was expose the fragility of that and how easily that information can be hacked, broken into, disseminated. And in that sense, I do think we're living in the world of her making, where we're still reckoning with the aftermath of that.
She traveled with a security guard to your interview. Who's paying for the security guard?
She had a GoFundMe page at the end of her time in Leavenworth, and her supporters have consistently raised money on her behalf. She is, the security detail, as far as I know, is paid for by those funds. Her staff, she has a publicist who works pro bono. The ACLU works pro bono. Her lawyers are working, I think, partially pro bono, and also from funds provided by supporters. So she has a big network.
We don't have much time. Does she think she can return to normal life now as a woman?
Yes, I think she hopes she can. I think she can. I think she's a strong person. I think it'll take some time, but I think she'll get there.
Matthew Scherer's article, Becoming Chelsea Manning, appeared in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine, and we have a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org/lowpate. Matthew, thank you so much for being on our show today.
I appreciate it. Thank you.